You are listening to the Effective Statistician podcast, more or less weekly, but actually much more bi-weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. Today, I'm talking with Yannick Weber-Pals from Harvard about FAIR and how that applies to real-world evidence and what you can actually very practically do about that. So stay tuned. The Effective Statistician Conference will happen in November of this year, 2024. And there are lots of opportunities for you to contribute to it. You can submit abstracts for posters, for 80-minute presentations, for sessions, and for workshops. Check out the homepage at theeffectivestatistician.com and you'll find everything to the conference. Now, you can also register there and sponsor it, or your company can sponsor it. So sponsoring, we have three different tiers: the T-Test tier, the Innova tier, and the Machine Learning or ML tier. And these are basically bronze, silver, and gold, but I just found these kind of boring titles. So, and check out the homepage because there's lots of opportunities for your companies with these different tiers. Especially, it also includes 11, 23, or 48 slots, depending on which tier you select, free slots for the conference. And you only need to pay 10 times, 20 times, or 40 times the price of the regular attendance of the conference. Now, as the price for the different attendees move up over time, so does the sponsoring. So the earlier you sponsor the conference, the cheaper it becomes. So check out everything that you get in terms of sponsoring, and there's lots more than the free slots on the conference homepage. And just let me know if you are interested. Just send an email to Alexander at theeffectivestatistician.com if you want to sponsor the conference, and we can have a discussion about how we can make it the best deal for you and your company. Now, as you listen to this, the Effective Statistician Conference is months away. What is not so far away, actually happening next week, is the PSI Conference. PSI is a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. And I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI. If you want to join PSI, and you're not already a member because you're attending this great conference, you can get lots of different stuff to improve your statistical capabilities. For example, PSI webinars, the video on demand content library, and lots more. Head over to psiweb.org to learn more about it and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of the Effective Statistician. Today I'm super happy to have actually a listener on the show. It's always great to have people that benefit from the podcast to also provide things back to the community. And yeah, with that, I would like you to introduce you to Yannick Weber-Pals. So Yannick, tell us a little bit about your career and where you're up to now.
Hi, Alex. It's great to be here. So my name is Yannick. I'm an instructor in medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. By training, I'm a pharmacist and epidemiologist with particular interest in real-world data analytics and also methodology. So it's probably unusual for you to have someone on the podcast who's a pharmacist. My interest in statistics and data science and statistical programming came from really working in practice. because at some point when I was at the end of my pharmacy training, I was really wondering, like, how can I quantify treatment effects besides like the pharmacology and biological basics I learned? And how can I determine if like drug A or drug B is the better and safer choice for the patient that is in front of me? And so I, at some point I started teaching myself like R programming and also did a research stay in the US. And this is how I got into touch with the field of pharmacoepidemiology, which is basically the academic discipline behind like real-world evidence and real-world data. And so I decided to do a PhD at the German Cancer Research Center, and then also did a postdoctoral fellowship in data science and early drug development at Roche, and then also worked for some time in industry. And then in 2022, decided to come back to academia. And here I'm now focused on working on real-world evidence questions and methodological questions in the area of oncology.
Yeah. And we already had a colleague from you on the show a couple of months earlier, or maybe already a year earlier, Shirley Wang, who talked about Duplicate. And that project is about how you can potentially recreate data from clinical trials and replicate them in real-world evidence data. And you're now doing something similar in the oncology space, which is very, very interesting. All these different therapeutic indications definitely have big differences in terms of how they replicate in claims databases. So I've seen that already from the other RCT duplicate papers. So that is really, really interesting work to help us better understand what is possible and which indications and where are the strengths and limitations. So please continue to do these kind of things. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. I fully agree. And as I said, like in these different therapeutic indications and areas, really different problems come, or it's like you have all sorts of different problems, because in the first like RCT duplicate, it was more about like cardiovascular and diabetes, which you can study pretty well in claims data. But then when you move to oncology, you need really like access to specialty information like biomarkers and electronic health records. And then you have all the problems like missing data. And so it's another type of problem set that we have here.
Yeah, definitely. So I'll look forward to maybe that we speak about that at a different in a future episode, because today we want to talk about a much more kind of fundamental problem that is all around programming and transparency. I had already a couple of different guests on the show, and today I want to talk with Yannick, because he actually provides some really kind of hands-on experience. So when it comes to reproducibility, why is that actually important?
Yeah, that's a very big question that you're asking. But like, so Shirley Wang and I, we published together a paper that introduces a specific software that's called Git, that is like really like the Swiss knife tool to use for reproducibility when you do like hands-on coding and implementation of statistical programming. And we had several motivations for that paper. So first of all, there's guidelines for study pre-specification, like templates of protocols to write, which is very important. And then there are also reporting guidelines like STROPE and RECORD and so on. But there's not really something about the implementation-backed best practices when you implement a study, because there are so many things that can go wrong and there's really a need to have better transparency and also reproducibility for code. So in the most ideal setting, you either like provide, for example, like a software package, like an R package that comes as packaged tool to reproduce certain analyses all over again. Or if you have, for example, if you did analytics on a specific study, the most ideal way is that you could basically just use the same code and redo the analysis all over again without changing anything. And that's really the problem set. And I think we're still, especially in pharmacoepidemiology and real-world evidence, we're far away from that. So I was at a conference last year, and in terms of, like, for example, code sharing, a group did a systematic review on code sharing, and it was, they found that just 5% of all real-world evidence studies actually share code. So we really don't know what's going on behind the scenes, because you can write a lot of things in the protocol, and the protocol is very important. But what it really comes down to is how you programmed it, because you can write it one way in the protocol, but if you implement it really the same way, that's the big question that we're all after.
Yeah, and especially with real-world evidence. Yeah, real-world data is so messy. There's so many kind of different aspects you can do it. And if you then want to replicate your analysis, yeah, for example, especially with real-world evidence, you have new data, you have more data, you have updated data, yeah? Then you want to do it again. And yeah, maybe, you know, you have left the institution, yeah? And now someone else needs to pick that up, yeah? Or there is another institution that works on the same data set, yeah? And wants to kind of do maybe some modifications to it. And in order to modify something, you need to start with your baseline, yeah? So you first start to replicate the same things. And if you have ever tried to do that on a clinical trial, that is already hard. On real-world evidence, it's way more complicated, yeah? Because very often you have much more messy data, and not only more messy, but just more data. So that also makes it much more complex. So in your paper that you wrote with Shirley, you call it a verification of research in real-world evidence. So, and there is the capital FAIR in it. So can you quickly speak about what FAIR stands for?
Yeah, definitely. So FAIR is actually comes from data, so that data is findable, accessible, interoperable, and reproducible. Mm-hmm. And we thought that we extend that not only to data, but also to the code that you use to produce a certain statistical output, yeah. Because all the code should be findable, accessible, interoperable, and like reproducible, so that the intention of the study that you wrote in the protocol is like really reproducible. And that does not like just that actually starts with also how you, for example, label and name the programs where you coded up your analysis. Because, for example, as a PhD student, I often found that things were labeled like main analysis one, main analysis two, main analysis final. And then the question is like, really, which is the actual script that produced the output? I don't know. And this is just where it starts. So this is not even going into the topic of Git and like having a track record of, or an audit trail of changes that you did, but just like, which is the actual code program that produces the output that I want.
Yeah. So findable, this kind of first thing that on, you know, most of the statisticians in pharma will say, well, that's easy, that, you know, you have the tables and the footnotes point to the source, yeah, the path, and so on. The problem, of course, is this path is not readily available to lots of people. And of course, these tables will then be used further, for example, in publications, in slides, in all kinds of different things. And then people will use these slides to create other slides. And from these other slides, they will create further stuff like promotional material. And from the promotional material, another publication is done or whatsoever. Yeah. So very often kind of these things travel through multiple layers. And later on, even if you don't have a footnote, yeah, that tells you, well, that is in folder XYZ, yeah, you still want to find this stuff. Yeah. So just relying on, oh, yeah, we have these tables with the footnotes is not enough. Also, if you work with CROs and, you know, these kind of areas, it becomes even harder. Yeah. So making sure that your code is really findable makes a huge difference. Then also your results are findable. Yeah, because, well, with the code comes usually also the results. And that's yet another thing. So that is the F. Can you repeat what the A stands for?
Yeah, so that's accessible. So that means that the code is not like siloed, maybe on like personal drive or somewhere where no one else has access to it, but that you, for example, have all of the things that are important to reproduce your study are compiled into one, what we often call like repository. And that repository is then can be, for example, found in a remote, for example, in the cloud. So there are often cloud remote repositories where you can connect your code to and synchronize it with. Often this is like GitHub, GitLab, Bitbucket. So these are the, like the three big players that most of the people use. And that's the cloud instances where you can synchronize your code with so that everyone really has access to this one central repository where all of the important things are stored.
So that means, for example, in the case of R, also any macros, packages, and please forgive me if I'm not using the right names because I'm not an R programmer, all these kind of other things that help you to run the code are also all in there.
Yeah, exactly. So when, for example, I implement a study, something I also have there is, for example, the study protocol. I have all of my scripts that I use to clean the data, that I use to do the descriptives, the main analyses, the sensitivity analyses. I often then have all of the table outputs and, for example, the figures stored there. I have general information about the project, like what's the overall scope, what's the IRB information, the instructions on how to install the software, for example, R packages and the corresponding versions that I use to do that, to run the analyses, and like everything that is required so that someone else could just very easily grab that code and reproduce my analyses.
So that is really cool that you have all the metadata there. Yeah. The data about the data so that it actually makes sense and you can understand it. Awesome. Let's go to the I.
Right. Interoperable. So that is something that is maybe a bit harder to do in terms of the data analysis, but something how we defined it in the paper was that the code is written in a way that is like easily understandable and that someone else can really do the analysis without adjusting much of the code or any of the code. For example, something that is often like a first hurdle is that one defines like absolute paths. For example, if you want to grab some data, for example, from an SQL server or from your hard drive or wherever the data is stored, and then you have like the path to the data that is like specific to your computer, and that should not be the case. So we, in the paper, we then describe that this path should be like relative paths so that it can adapt to the user's environment and it's not like that the code doesn't break at this very point.
Yeah, that is awesome. I think it also means that, for example, the results are stored in such a way that you can easily work further with them. So for me, that, for example, means that your summary statistics are not just stored in a PDF, but also in a data set. Yeah, so that if you want to then use these for, don't know, comparing it to your next and updated analysis, you don't need to kind of scrape it or, you know, manually type it in again or something like this.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's a real bad habit in our industry that we store summary statistics in PDFs or RTFs or anything like that, not in well-documented data sets that are much easier to use. Okay, let's close with the R of FAIR.
Yeah, well, the R is basically everything that this is about, which is the reproducibility, so that which brings together like everything so that you can go to the remote repository, you can clone the repository onto your local machine, you can run the code, and then you hopefully get the like really exact same numerical results as someone else.
That is pretty cool. Yeah, and I had Heidi Seibold on the show already, who talked about a couple of different things around reproducibility. And so you can also scroll a little bit backwards in that. Now, what you did is you, in your paper, provided a step-by-step guidance through, I think, something like 10 steps, so that you can do Git and R on a real-world study effectively. So It starts with installing Git, yeah, which is probably a pretty much straightforward thing. And then it goes through a couple of different further steps. What do you think are the steps which makes the biggest difference if you kind of not miss on these?
Yeah, that's a pretty good question. So in the paper, we really just cover the really, really basics to create a baseline reproducible workflow, because Git is such a powerful software. I work with Git on a daily basis, and I would not dare to say I know everything about Git. I think you can go really, really deep into Git and what you can actually do with it, because it was set up, first of all, as a software to manage the development of Linux, so the operating system Linux. That was the birth of Git, what it was initially developed for. And then it expanded also to other areas. And I think before going into the different steps, it's also good to know and what Git actually is. And Git is a distributed version control system, which is basically a time machine, if you want, to the code that you've developed and the changes that you did to it. So at every single time point where you do snapshots, and the snapshots or the frequency of snapshots that you can do, we call this in Git like commits. This is something that is up to you. And there are different philosophies or different approaches to it. I usually handle it that I commit often and early, so that I have a very granular audit trail of the changes that I did to my code. And if there's like a very fundamental like version that I want to, for example, snapshot, you can do additional things like create branches or add a tag to it, so you exactly know that this is the version that I use, for example, to reproduce the results that I submitted to as an abstract to the conference, or for example, that I use for the first version of the manuscript that I sent to a journal. And also in industry, you could say this is then the snapshot or the tag that I used as the version that I sent to FDA or EMA, things like that. And so this is the basic workflow where you do changes to your files, you stage them. So staging means you determine which changes should be included in this snapshot or commit. And then in the commit, you create this like local snapshot of the changes made with, like, for example, a short informative message, so you know what was changed. And the beautiful thing about Git is then afterwards, you can then, for example, on GitHub or GitLab, can really see the additions and the deletions that you did to the code and everything that correspondingly changed. And then you can push this, for example, then to a remote repository, be it GitHub, GitLab, Bitbucket. And then if you, for example, work collaboratively with someone on the code, you also want to make sure that you often pull or fetch the changes that maybe someone else did to the code. So everything's in synchronization. So you can say that, for example, Git is like the track changes part of what you often have in Word, just that you have it longitudinally. So all the changes, not like one-time changes. And then GitHub, GitLab is basically like a Dropbox or Google Drive where the track changes are stored onto.
Yeah. And you can work with a couple of different people kind of at the same time in the same areas. Yeah, like, you know, Kubernetes can do also with teams and things like that. So that's pretty awesome. Yeah, and pretty fundamental to coding because you can see every step. You can also see who did it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Who and when the changes were done.
Yeah. So that is how it works with Git. And I think this makes a huge benefit. By the way, in the paper, there are a couple of really, really nice graphics, screenshots, and ways to show how that actually then looked like in real. So if you don't have any experience in that regard, it's this very, very detailed step-by-step guidance. So this is pretty awesome. Now, learning about this is, of course, you can read the paper. What else could you do to get better at these kind of things?
Yeah, and I think that that's also a very good question, because I think at universities or where you usually get your education, they're not like really courses dedicated to Git or version control. So how I learned it was more like by myself. So I more or less self-taught with different things that you can find online and also while I was on the job. And there are a couple of courses or papers or tutorials that you can find all over the internet. And we compiled actually a non-exhaustive, but still a comprehensive list of, for example, Coursera courses or EDX courses or other courses that do explain Git like from scratch to a very advanced level. And you can do that at your own pace. And you can also find a lot of like tutorials online, like whatever works best for you. If you're more like the visual type or the reading type, I think there's something that you can find online that works for everyone. And in the supplementary part of our paper, we actually compiled a comprehensive list of courses that we would recommend.
That is awesome. And the supplementary part is hopefully available for free, or is that behind a paywall?
That's a good question. I would need to check myself, but we have also made the repository that we actually used to write the manuscript. This is openly accessible, and you will also find the supplementary material in there.
Okay, very good. Then we will definitely put a link to this in the show notes so that you can easily find it. Thanks so much, Yannick, to talk about reproducibility, about the specific problems of creating something that is fair and what actually fair means. And I highly recommend that you go and check out this paper that goes through all these different steps very, very detailed. And as Yannick mentioned, you can very, very easily access that via the link in the show notes. So Yannick, that is awesome. What is the biggest benefit that you have seen from people using these kind of reproducible things?
So when I think about my development in statistical programming, a benefit that I really had was looking at other people's code, especially if you work in this statistical or data science area and you read about a new methodology that you would really like to implement in your own study. The question is just like, how do you do it? And the worst way to do it you can, of course, like just do it depending on the theory that you read in the paper, but then you never know if you really implemented it correctly. And so if people provide code to implement the new methodology, then you can just basically grab the code and implement it in your own study. And that is the largest benefit that I found for myself, that if someone publishes code along with the methodology, it's much easier to apply that methodology to another research question or topic. So that would be one part of the answer. And the other thing that I find quite beneficial is that sometimes you may also like mess up your own code, and then while you develop the code for your statistical analysis, and then you are pretty safe if you have everything in an audit trail using Git, so you can always go back to the previous version and see what changed, and that you can basically then reconcile everything again. Also, something if you, for example, made a change after, for example, the review comes back from a manuscript or from a regulatory authority, and you implement the changes, you can very easily see how the changes in your code then reflect the changes in the results, and also make sure that every time you rerun your code, you get the same results.
Yeah. These are awesome benefits just for yourself. And I'm not talking about the benefits for all the others that will need to work with your code. So thanks so much, Yannick. All the best.
Thank you so much, Alex. It was a pleasure to be here.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who helped with the show in the background. And thank you for listening. And don't forget to check out whether your company actually wants to sponsor the Effective Statistician Conference and get lots of benefits from it. And the faster you act on it, the less you know about what will exactly happen at the conference, but the cheaper it will be, or more cost effectiveness this will be for you. So invest a little bit of money and you'll have a great conference for lots of people from your organization. Or if you want to give the free slots to someone else, then you can also get them to someone else. Thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.